Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 218 on Friday, October 5th, 2012. Greetings from Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I started my preparation of today's show in what I would guess is one of the highest volume Starbucks locations in the world. It's a two-story facility, and from the huge windows on the second floor, you look out at the out-of-town news agency, an icon in Harvard Square, the Harvard Coop, and entrances to Harvard Yard. It's a pretty studious setting compared with my favorite Denver Starbucks, which is in Rider Square Lodo. This morning in Harvard Square, everyone was working on their own, no power business meetings or job interviews apparently taking place around the little tables. 9 out of 10 customers were working on laptops or smaller screens. Although Darlene is not a fan of Starbucks, she did join me at a large common table, and she was using her Kindle for iPad app to read a vegan recipe book for ideas. I did a quick walk around the room, and of 40 people there this morning, I counted not a single e-ink Kindle, though Darlene might not have been the only one that was reading on a Kindle app. It's been a while since I've seen a demographic survey of Kindle users, but I suspect that we skew a little older than the average age of the Starbucks at Harvard Square. My guest this week is no stranger to Harvard Square and environs. Yael Goldstein Love graduated from Harvard College in 2000 with an honors degree in philosophy, and she is now co-founder and editorial director of Plimpton, a literary startup to which Amazon turned for 3 of the first 8 offerings in the new Kindle serials genre.
But we have no idea what to read, right? I mean, it's this vast sea of content. And so these curated lists, like what they did with Kindle singles, are so useful because you say, okay, this is the kind of thing I want to read. I like these Kindle singles. And I think the serials could be the same sort of thing, and in some sense, even more convenient. Because if you find a serial that you really like, well, gosh, you have just this lovely stream of content coming to you that you know you like. So I think it is a real new twist that they're doing for it.
There will be lots more to talk about this episode, including mainly rave reviews for the newly arrived Kindle Paperwhite and a settlement in the Google eBooks lawsuit, which may bode well for Kindle users, if I'm understanding it correctly. The tech tips are going to include a look back at e-ink Kindles of yore and how you can keep them up to date with the latest software. And at the end of this episode, I'm going to let you know which part of the Kindle Chronicles has the fewest fans. That's according to results from the SurveyMonkey questions that I posed last week. The top news story this week, as it was last week, is the Kindle Paperwhite, which is now in the hands of lots of you. I've heard from a number of listeners with impressions of this new member of the Kindle family, and also have had a chance to look at some of the reviews which came in once the embargo was lifted on the review copies that were distributed a little bit in advance. I was pretty amazed when I got my own video review up at the deadline when the embargo came off. I think it was at 9 p.m. on Sunday night. It was fun to see all of the rest come in, and I thought they were uniformly positive, real rave reviews. And sometimes I've noticed in the past the critics, the tech bloggers and the tech journalists of one stripe or another have been a little hard on Kindle devices, and you've seen sort of a chorus of criticism of the criticism by users in the forums and elsewhere who say, oh no, this is a great device. It almost seemed like it was a little bit the reverse this time, that the professional reviewers tended to be quite positive. And then I've seen, not only in some of your emails, but heard from in the forums, that there have been some criticisms coming up as well. So as an example of what I would characterize as strong support for the device among the professionals, Joshua Topolsky, who used to be with Engadget, now he's with The Verge, did an excellent video review which came up right away, and this is how he concluded it.
In all, the Kindle Paperwhite is a terrific e-reader. The software is fast and intuitive. The display is crisp, and the battery life is outstanding. Amazon's taken an already good product and made it a great product. And I strongly recommend this device for people who really love reading.
Now, compared to that review, I'm going to share some comments that I've heard from you listeners to the show who hit on some common themes, and I want to take the time to go through them in some detail, because I think if you're trying to figure out whether you want to buy a Kindle Paperwhite or perhaps stick with a Touch or another device, some of this information may be useful to you. The first example I have is from Chris Kraft, who is CEO and co-founder of Splash Media in Dallas. He emailed me today, I just got my Paperwhite and love it. I have found a few shortcomings in my device, but I don't want to dogpile just yet. Long story short, I have two main issues. One, I have some hot spots near the bottom of my screen when the light is on. It's more pronounced on the higher settings, but it makes a noticeable blemish on an otherwise flawless e-ink screen. I wonder if my unit is defective. I'm going to stop there and just comment on that, because I think that's an item that I have heard quite a bit. And I do notice it on the review copy that I receive from Amazon. I haven't received the one that I purchased for myself yet. But it's at the bottom of the screen is where the light apparently, it's the source of the light on the Paperwhite. If you lean your device so that you're looking down into the bottom of the bezel around the screen, you can actually see what look to be four lights. And by comparison, on the Nook, which I'm sure has a very similar technology since they're both coming out of e-ink, on the Nook Simple Touch with Glow Light, the light is coming from the top of the screen. And I think that, as the Wall Street Journal pointed out, it's a better choice to have the light source be at the bottom, because it just seems less distracting to have the discoloration or the blurriness, or however you want to describe it, coming at the bottom of the screen. I think it's better at the bottom of the screen than the top. If you angle the Nook so that you're sort of looking parallel along the surface of it to the top of the screen, you can actually see what look to be eight lights. So the light sources on the Nook, there are twice as many as there seems to be on the Kindle. And I find that the quality of the light is better on the Kindle than the Nook. But there's no denying that if you start looking at the top of the screen and then move your eyes down, on mine here, you start seeing what sort of look like shadows at the very bottom line. In other words, where it says 44% finished and 1 hour 17 minutes left in this book, that's where I'm seeing just a little bit of a fuzziness. It's almost like looking at a horizon of low mountains, kind of New Hampshire-type mountains as opposed to Colorado-type mountains. A little bit of a blurry profile of hills or mountains. It frankly doesn't bother me. I guess I'm sufficiently impressed that this screen has gotten better and better over the past 5 years, that if this is the only part that isn't perfect, it doesn't bother me. But I think it's important to point out, because if you're expecting a perfect screen, and you know some of the pictures seem to make it look that way, you may well end up thinking you've got a defective unit because of the pattern that these lights form at the bottom. It's pretty clear to me that if you're looking at something that sounds like what I'm talking about here, it's not a defective unit. It's pretty much the way they all come out. So let's continue with Chris Kraft. He says, I took my fully charged Paperwhite on a day trip, round trip flight to Memphis from DFW, and the battery indicator showed 50% when I got home. I figure I used the device for about 3 full hours with the light on. Well, that's that sounds like quite a bit less battery life than is being advertised. So that's, I have not given it sort of a stress test on battery life. I generally plug in my Kindles overnight here in my office, and so unless I'm on a really long trip, they never really get tested that way. But there's an indication that maybe that battery life is an issue. This is Chris's third point is interesting. He says, gestures. I'm having a hard time finding a great websites showing you all the ways you can use gestures on the touch screen. I'm wondering if you could do a how-to video. Well, this is a good idea that this would be a good Kindle video extra that I could put together to see if I can do a little gesture tutorial. Coming from a third-gen keyboard device, Chris writes, I have to admit I am feeling a little lost with touch actions only. I'd like to see someone walk me through all the gestures in a video. I wonder how many others are struggling like I am. Well, I've talked about this in the past, but I know, you know, my parents, as one, tried the touch and just never did get the hang of it, so now they're both using the Kindle keyboard and very happy with it. And Darlene has always had difficulty with the touch. So that's some good points from Chris Kraft at Splash Media. Also heard from Candy Yates, who had a thoughtful review. She wrote, I have been comparing my new Kindle Paperwhite to the Touch this morning and found some things I wanted to share. I noticed that when you turn the light all the way down, it never really goes off. At first I didn't like that, but now I don't mind because it gives you a very slight glow that is helpful in a darker room, but not so dark that you need more light. I also noticed that with the light down as far as it will go, the screens are two different colors of gray. This doesn't matter, I just noticed. Also, with the light at any brightness, low or high, the screen is not white, but almost blue. Again, this doesn't matter, but I hate calling it a paper white when it isn't white. Just my OCD, what's that? Obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD coming through. Well, I think it's a fair point. I've heard other people talk about the color of it. I may be a little colorblind. It looks more white to me than blue. I'm sure if they'd called it a paper blue, it wouldn't have pleased the marketing people. But yeah, it's not as white as this piece of paper I'm looking at, for sure. But I think the point is it's whiter than it used to be, and that's maybe why they thought they could use that name. Candy continues, some things I absolutely love. The light, of course, that was the whole reason for getting it. It also has a really great feature where you can see how long it will take you to finish the book or the chapter you are in based on your reading speed. I love that because two of my previous Kindles had dots at the bottom that told you if a chapter was long or short, and you could judge about how long it would take you to read it. The Touch didn't have those, and I missed them. With this feature on the new Kindle, it, quote, watches you read, times how long it takes you to read something, and calculates how long it will take to read each chapter and ultimately the whole book. You can set it to glance down at any time and see how long you have left in the chapter. I love that. I agree with Candy. This is one of my favorite features of the Paperwhite, and it's what's sad is that it depends on the book being formatted with chapter endings, and if you don't have that chapter endings in the format, you're just going to see how long it's going to take to finish the whole book. And for my continuing slog through War and Peace, that's always kind of a discouraging number that shows up. You have it should be saying at the rate you're reading this book, including the pauses, you will finish it when you're 75 years old. That would be even better information. Candy continues, a lot of people talk about how much faster it is than the Touch, but I really can't tell a difference. However, there is more room on the Touch than this one, giving it more room to work. I think she's talking about memory there. Books may download a little faster to the Paperwhite, but not enough to make a huge difference. As far as page turns, I found them to be exactly the same. Same with opening a book from your homepage. One thing I do like is that you have to mean to turn the page on the Paperwhite. On my Touch, anything would turn the page. A leaf falling onto the screen, for instance. That's a great image. I until Candy had mentioned that, I had sort of intuited that the Touch was more reliable on the Paperwhite, and I'm putting that off to the fact it's a capacitive screen rather than an optical. And I know one of Darlene's biggest complaints about the Touch is the times that she's inadvertently ended up somewhere in a book and where she hasn't meant to be. We haven't ordered a Paperwhite for her yet, and I've been too interested in reading this one to let her try it much, but at some point I'm going to turn this over to her, or maybe she can use the one that I'm going to get, and see if she finds it more reliable in its touch controls than the Kindle Touch. I have a feeling that it's going to be better on that, but Candy does a good job of describing how sensitive the Touch is to leaves falling on the screen, as an example. She continues, I know it is due to each Kindle using a different type of touch screen. You can feel the difference, too. The touch is smooth while the Paperwhite is slightly rough feeling. I'd noticed that, too. It's almost like a matte finish. I like that there isn't as much room between the screen and the casing because my touch stays dusty in corners unless I get a Q-tip and wipe it out. That may be more that OCD. I have yet to apply a Q-tip to any of my Kindles, but it's probably a good idea. The Paperwhite has less distance between the two so that when you wipe the screen, you get the corners too. Now, what Candy doesn't like, the fonts. They're different. That shouldn't matter, she says, but it does to her. For one thing, I had to increase the font size by one in order to make the letters the same size as they were on the touch with a smaller size setting. I know that isn't a big deal, but I just didn't like it. Also, I had to set the line spacing further apart. In my opinion, the fonts seem to show up bolder and more crisp on the touch than the Paperwhite. The light seems to take away some of the contrast, but only a little. Even with the light all the way down, the touch seems bolder and more crisp. Of course, though, the light could not be beat in a darker room. This is on the Paperwhite. Some other things that bother me. One, you cannot swipe up or down to go to next or previous chapter. Now, that might be something that Darlene would like, because I think sometimes when she found herself in a place in the book she didn't want to go to, she might have inadvertently swiped up or down instead of to the left or right. Two, there is an extra step to turning off Wi-Fi. This is something I hadn't noticed until Candy pointed it out. Rather than just hitting menu and choosing turn off Wi-Fi or turn off wireless, you now have to hit menu, go to settings, then select turn on airplane mode. This turns off Wi-Fi. Three, I miss having text-to-speech, even though I don't use it that much. Four, no one mentioned that the black spots along the bottom were normal because the lights are located there, which I had talked about. She sums up, I know I have only worked with it a short time, but at this point, if I had to choose which one to keep, it would be the touch. I want to read on it for a while in different lighting conditions and see how this light affects my eyes before I decide. Now, since writing that, she included an addendum and said, this was my initial review, and I did end up sending the Paperwhite back for a refund. I just couldn't seem to find a light setting that didn't strain my eyes. I'm anxious to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You know, my impression of the readability of the Paperwhite is that it's I greatly prefer it to the reading on the touch. And I think what I'm always see in comments about these e-ink screens is how subjective each of us, I think, is looking at something slightly different, because you get dramatically different impressions of the same screen. And I think when it gets to the way the optics work in the eye, and there's a lot going on there that is beyond sort of simple science. But I doubt that Candy's going to be alone in thinking that the touch gives her a better reading experience. And it's a good thing that you've got 30 days. You can turn the Paperwhite back and then go back to the touch if that, that might be the right choice. Tom Semple wrote this about the Paperwhite. He says, my new KPW, those are good initials for the Kindle Paperwhite, is waiting for me to unbox it when I get home. This is what he said as he was writing. I'm trying to keep my expectations in check. On mobilread.com, there's a Are You Happy With Your Paperwhite Screen? Statistically worthless poll, he notes. Currently, it is only 3-1 in favor. Three who are happy with their screen and one opposed, I guess. Some of the no votes are people who got defective units, some from people who failed to account for how marketing photos are always impeccably lit and photographed for maximum effect. But my benchmark is that it should be clearly better than my Kindle Touch with a lighted cover, not that it needs to be perfect. And as I pointed out in the video that I did, to me, that's one of the big advantages, is not having to have a cover with a light. And, you know, some great lights are out there, and I ship lots of lights from M-Edge to the Troops for eBooks for Troops, and it's certainly a great feature to have a light that you can attach to your Kindle with a case. But I don't think anybody would disagree that it's more convenient to not have to have a separate light and to have this light built into the screen. So for me, that's one of the beauties of this next generation of Kindle. It just seems simpler because of that feature. The other thing I like is that when I have it in this Kindle case, it goes to sleep as soon as I close the case, and then when I open it up, the light is on, and all I have to do is swipe in any direction to get it going. The Nook, by comparison, when you turn it on, you have to go to there's a separate step of holding the little N button down for a couple of seconds, and then the light comes on. But that simple little advantage of the Paperwhite is pleasing to me every time. I don't have to turn it off. I don't have to turn it on. All I have to do is open that cover, and it greets me with its shiny little screen. I've got two more bits of email from listeners, both disappointed with the Paperwhite. We'll finish up with them. Karen Hagland wrote, "It breaks my heart to say this, but I am so disappointed with the Paperwhite. I don't like the uneven lighting on the screen. I have the blackish smudges on the bottom from where the lights are placed and blotches of uneven light color on most of the screen." That makes me think maybe this might be a defective unit, because the upper part of my screen is very kind of clear and uniform. She says the upper right corner looks pinkish and the upper middle center bluish. I may have received a lemon, but if so, Amazon has sent out a lot of lemons. My issues are not unique. The forums are full of similar descriptions and photos documenting it. The problem is very noticeable on a screen with little text, but even on a screen full of text, it is distracting. She says it's a shame, as this Kindle is supposed to represent the top of the line. I'm so glad I still have the Touch, which I love. I feel sorry for those who sold their Touches to buy the Paperwhite, as now they may not have a Kindle they are happy with. And then I also heard from Kate Harper, who wrote, "I don't like the Paperwhite. I'm so bummed. I wanted it mainly so I could read in bed without disturbing my husband, but the flash in between pages is just too intense for my eyes. It's almost like I can feel the pupils dilate as if someone is taking my picture, and the screen also has tinted colors sweeping across the screen that are distracting. It's too bad because everything else is great. The screen is more responsive and the tools are set up simpler. Bummer. I think I'm going to return it." The flash that Kate mentions, you know, that you have every five pages, the e-ink screen resets itself. This is described by Sri Paravemba in my interview with him at e-ink. I did notice that at first, but I'm not noticing it now after reading on it for a week and a half. And I seem to remember a similar period where I noticed that flash between pages on the e-ink Kindles, and then all of a sudden I just didn't. So it might be that particular part of this is accentuated because you're reading it with a built-in light, but it seems to be an effect that fades away. In general, if you've got comments about the Paperwhite, at this point the comments from listeners are running a little negative, so if you've got you feel good about it and you've got some positive things to say, or any, I don't want to try to skew the sample here, but you can send me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com, or you can leave a comment at the show notes page, which is thekindlechronicles.com, or the Facebook page, facebook.com/thereadingedge. We'll see. I have a feeling they're selling pretty well because the delivery dates keep extending out into the future. So in general, it seems to be off to a pretty strong start, but there have been a few discouraging words, and it's worth talking about. The next story I want to mention in news briefly is the Google ebook settlement. This is just with the publishers. The lawsuit by the Authors Guild is still continuing, claiming that Google's scanning of 20 million books infringes the copyright rights of authors. But the publishers have settled, and in the stories, I was reading as many of these stories as I could. The one thing I wanted to make sure was the case is that the digital copies of books that publishers will receive, if they allow Google to keep their scanned books in the Google eBooks library, will they be available for, say, sale in the Kindle store? And there's a line in the Financial Times story yesterday, October 4th, which seems to say, yes, that's the case. The FT writes, Google will have to give digital copies of its scanned books to publishers and allow them to sell the work via other online stores. As a Kindle partisan, this makes me feel good because when the settlement, the more global settlement was underway, it looked like Google was going to maintain, be able to freeze out the Mobi format and the Kindle format from the books that it was going to be offering that were out of copyright, out of print, but would be made available through the big settlement. Now that there's a separate piece being made with the publishers, it looks like a lot of these books, and it could be hundreds of thousands or millions, will be able to make their way onto formats that we can read on the Kindle. So if I'm reading this right, that's good news. Quickly for tech tips, I was preparing books to send to soldiers for ebooks for troops the last couple of days, and a lot of Kindle 2s went out and also Kindle 3s. If you simply Google Kindle software update, you'll come to a page that makes it very easy to find out if you've got the latest software on your Kindle 2. It goes all the way back to the Kindle first generation. And you can simply download the software updates to your Kindle and then do an update. I've got it's pretty easy to do. It helps when you're doing it, you know, 10 or 20 times in a day. So I've become sort of an expert in this process. And in a related note, Tom Semple noted that the Whisper Sync for Voice is enabled for the Audible player on the Kindle keyboard via the recent 3.4 update. I was reading something that said that you couldn't sync with Whisper Sync for Voice on the Kindle keyboard, but with that update performed, I think you can, and Tom suggests there'll be one for the Touch as well. He also passed along a good tip, which is on the current Kindle, I'm looking at the Paperwhite. If you choose something in the cloud view, which is the archives, and you tap and hold on an individual book, it brings up add to home or item description. So if you're looking through your archive, or especially if you share an archive with somebody, there's a handy way to get a description of a book if you want to learn more about it to find out if it's something that you do want to download to your device. So thanks, Tom Semple, for those good tips. Time now for the interview. I had a chance to meet in person with Yael Goldstein Love here at the house in Cambridge, and I began by just asking her to give a description of the startup that she is a co-founder of named Plimpton.
Plimpton is a literary studio. We're calling it a literary studio and not a publishing house for various reasons. One of those reasons is that we work very much with the writers, sort of helping to create the products, sort of more on the studio model. And we are devoted exclusively right now to creating serialized fiction for digital readers. So very narrow focus.
You see someday, will you be publishing novels and other types of, or is the whole vision about serials?
Right now, the vision is about serials. I think we're open to doing many different things. And in fact, our next project, although we call it a serial, it could just as easily be called an anthology of short stories. We are calling it a serial with many authors. But what it is actually is it's lots of different very long short stories about love in the digital age. It's called Wink Poke, and we're getting some very exciting writers signed on for it. And, you know, we say it's a serial with many authors, but you could call it many other things. So we're open to lots of different experiments.
And that'll also come out episodically?
That'll be episodic as well. So it'll sort of be the same thing where, you know, you subscribe and, you know, each week you'll have something new.
Now, why are fiction writers as a group depressed?
Well, I think there are a few reasons. One, I think we're temperamentally a depressive lot. and then I also think, you know, fiction writers are just so confused and scared, I think is the real thing. You know, the world of fiction, publishing, selling, all of that is changing dramatically. You know, it used to be that it was the corner bookstore that hand sold your books. Well, the corner bookstore barely exists anymore. You know, it used to be that the big publishers, you know, they were run by these gentlemen literary lovers who just wanted to publish beautiful things and burnish their reputation that way and use their family's money. And now they're owned by major media conglomerates that want the bottom line. And so, you know, fiction lists have been every year, you know, fiction lists get cut more and more. It feels to a lot of fiction writers like all the publishing houses care about are the big blockbusters, not the beautiful literary novels. And so it's a scary time. And then ebooks comes into this and fiction writers just, you know, we don't know what to make of this, right? I mean, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? Is this our salvation? Is this our doom? And so I think there's just so much confusion, and out of that confusion comes a lot of depression.
Amazon announced the Kindle Serials at the press conference on September 6th. They kind of skipped right from Dickens to Kindle Serials. Do you think it's been fair criticism of Amazon that they're trying to make it look like they're creating something that is at the least kind of a shared creation?
It's always hard to share full credit with everyone. It's almost an impossible task. I feel like you would be endlessly talking about who else had done what you had already done if you were going to be really thorough. I think it is, you know, it's true that there have been other attempts to revive the serial form. I mean, The Bonfire of the Vanities was serialized, I think, in Rolling Stone. There was a Michael Chabon book that was serialized. There's been, you know, some other modern serials. But it's never really taken off. And so I think it's legitimate for Amazon to be saying, you know, they're reviving it in the sense that they're going to make it a genre again. I mean, they're going to make it a format that writers write in and that people look to buy. And I think that they do have a distinct advantage in doing that because it's just so convenient what they're doing. I mean, you don't have to, you know, buy Rolling Stone. You don't have to buy, you know, remember to read that week's New York Times Magazine or whatever it is. You have it on your e-reader. It automatically updates. And it's also, it's a time when I think people, it's so wonderful that we have, you know, on our e-readers and out on the internet so much to read, but we have no idea what to read, right? I mean, it's this vast sea of content. And so these curated lists, like what they did with Kindle singles, are so useful because you say, okay, well, okay, this is the kind of thing I want to read. I like these Kindle singles. And I think the serials could be the same sort of thing, and in some sense, even more convenient, because if you find a serial that you really like, well, gosh, you have just this lovely stream of content coming to you that you know you like. So I think it is a real new twist that they're doing for it. And I think it has a much better shot at establishing itself than previous revivals of serial.
How important do you think it is, the idea that you buy it once and you get the rest of them automatically as opposed to having to buy each installment?
That is a fantastic question, and I would love to know the answer to that question. It's something we're thinking about a lot because I think, you know, it's not clear that we're going to be going through the serials program for our next books, partly because we want to be available on a lot of different platforms. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know how important that is. I don't know if, you know, people would be just as happy to keep buying each installment. I mean, in some sense, there's an advantage to that, right? You get to decide, do I want to keep reading this? It's always nice to have that choice. We always value things more when we have a choice. But I don't know. I wish I knew better, you know, how much more convenient that is. It's certainly a very, very, very cool feature that Amazon has added.
Jennifer Eightley?
Yeah.
That's a great name. She's got eight is her middle initial.
Eight is her middle initial, yes. She added that herself in high school, I believe.
Not ever to be forgotten. She has described Plimpton as a third layer in the publishing world, but an alternative to major publishers and the online markets. That's a fascinating concept. Are there other players in that third layer at this point, or are you sort of creating the third layer?
I think both. You know, I think there are other players. Two that we admire enormously are Byliner, who are just, they are doing fantastic things, and The Atavist, also doing wonderful things, and I think they'll be doing even more exciting things now with this Brightline, you know, Diller money coming in. That's very exciting.
I hadn't heard about that. What's that?
Oh, this is, Barry Diller and two other, I can't remember who are the two other people, two other really heavy hitters have invested, I think it's something like $10 million in The Atavist to add this other thing called Brightline that they'll be doing. It's not exactly clear to me, you know, what's going to be happening, but it's they want to add a fiction component. They're willing to put a lot of money into this. So I think, you know, that's going to be a really interesting addition to the third layer. At the same time, you know, I don't think it's something it's not something that people are talking about very much, you know, this third layer. And so I think, although there are some entrants into this market, it's also something that's still very much being created as we speak about it. And I think it's going to be very important because, I mean, when you think back to the, you know, when blogs first started to become a thing and everyone, there was this big distinction between blogs and journalism. And we thought like, well, what, okay, so there's going to be blogs and there's going to be journalism and one is professional and one isn't. And then we saw the professionalization of blogs. And not only did it change how we think about blogging, it very much changed how we think about journalism. And I think something very similar is going to start to happen here where, you know, we think about self-publishing or sort of online publishing and we think about traditional publishing. And I think, you know, as the professionalization of online publishing becomes more and more sophisticated, it's going to really change, you know, the whole publishing world's going to change how we think about fiction and nonfiction and the whole writing endeavor, I think.
Now, one thing which Jeff Bell emphasized when I talked with him a couple of weeks ago was the reader contact with the author through Kindle Serials, and they've got these discussion forums and everything, as if that was sort of the secret sauce of this. And I frankly am skeptical because at this point, the top-selling Kindle Serial has like 30 comments, and they're fairly bland. I can't really imagine that authors are going to be consulting these forums in the finishing of their work. But how do you folks see the that element, which I guess wasn't as possible in Dickens' day, to the success of this genre?
I think we're viewing it with curiosity. You know, I think it could become a big element. It would be sort of exciting if it did. I mean, I'm not surprised that it hasn't picked up yet. I mean, I think it's something that readers are going to have to get used to, because we just don't think of ourselves as crucially involved in informing a writer's work. And I think, you know, one thing that we are really hoping to build on our website, actually, when we get a more sophisticated website soon, is a forum for this, a sort of a place where readers really do gather and give their feedback. And, you know, it's interesting to me as a novelist. I wonder, I mean, how much would I like this? I'm asking my writers to do this. How would I like to do this? And I think it's a complicated question because, of course, if you have too much feedback, you can become utterly overwhelmed and paralyzed. But, you know, I think, you know, as a writer, you always do have to, it's so crucial to learn how to feel the weight of comments, like what feels right and what doesn't feel right, and to only go with what feels right. And when you do have, you know, those pieces of feedback that feel right, it's so valuable. And I see no reason why readers couldn't give that sort of feedback. So I think it could be exciting. And, you know, it's interesting. I don't know exactly how much, you know, Dickens or Tolstoy or James, you know, used reader feedback. I really don't imagine Henry James taking reader feedback well at all. But I do know that the Pickwick Papers, which was kind of the first, at least in the English language, sort of the first serial or the first popular serial, it was very unpopular initially. It just wasn't picking up, and partly because it was a new form. It takes a while for these new forms to pick up. But it was not until the fourth installment where he introduced the character of, what is he, like Sam Waller or something, that very charming manservant, a very amusing character. And people just loved that character. And all of a sudden, everyone was loving the Pickwick Papers. And he noticed that, and so he changed things to sort of make it, you know, have this character be more active and do other things like that. And so he very much was influenced by reader feedback, which is an interesting precedent.
What do you think the key elements for success are for a serialized novel?
Well, one, you know, some of them are the typical elements for success in any novel. You know, well written, you can, there's something about the characters that fascinates you and makes you want to know more about them. But I think what's really different with the serial than with, you know, a more traditionally told novel is that you need that through line of the plot to be so crystal clear. And it can never fall by the wayside, you know. So one thing that I'm constantly telling writers when I'm trying to recruit them is, you know, I love the meandering meditation on first love as much as the next person. We cannot have that as a serial. That does not work. There has to be a really compelling, clear plot line. It has to pull you on from episode to episode. And I think that's, I mean, in some ways that's a constraint, of course, having to put plot first and foremost. But I actually think in a way it's a constraint that's very freeing, especially for more literary writers who I think have in some ways gotten away from plot, at least some of them. And so to have the excuse to focus on a really fun, wild, you know, compelling plot can be a very freeing experience, I think. We'll see.
Now, you've got a Kickstarter project. Looks like it's just about to reach its goal of $30,000. Your last, when I checked this morning, it was $29,000 roughly with 8 days to go. What sorts of things will that money enable you to do?
In short, continue on. We need the money, and we're hoping to go above our goal. So if we can manage that, we'll be very, very glad. We need money for a bunch of things. I mean, one, probably the most important, we need to pay writers. You know, it's hard to, we believe in paying writers very, very strongly. We think you should be paid for your art. You should not just be writing for exposure. So that's first and foremost. And then we have to pay, our production editor, our copy editor, the people who make our covers, graphic artists. We have a lot of schemes up our sleeves for our website and some even more exciting things that are too inchoate to even talk about. So all of those sort of things. And eventually at some point, perhaps even to pay our editors. We can dream.
Which would be you.
Which would be me, yes. That's a beautiful dream I hold on to, yeah.
Well, let's loop back to the beginnings of all this. What can you tell me about the early history of Plimpton?
So Plimpton, you know, it's funny. The very earliest history of Plimpton's prehistory, I wasn't even a part of. It was Jenny Eight Lee had, I think it was out of a conversation actually with David Blum, who runs Kindle Singles, if I'm not mistaken. And he had just been saying, you know, how well it's doing, Kindle Singles, but that it was hard to find good content. And that perhaps it would be good for Jenny to get into, you know, some endeavor where she was actually producing good content. And she, of course, because she's a New York Times reporter for many years, wonderful, wonderful journalist. And so she first started thinking about, oh, well, maybe I'll do, you know, something with long form nonfiction. But there were a lot of entrants into this market already. Byliner had just launched recently, and there was a thought that, you know, any magazine that wanted to get into this could probably, you know, do it much better than she could just starting out. And so her thoughts turned to fiction. And she brought on another friend of ours from college who has a lot of experience starting companies and selling them. And they together thought, well, what can we do about this fact that we want to do fiction and we don't really know fiction? And this other fellow said, well, we know Yael and she's a novelist. Why don't we call her up and ask her advice? And they were actually just asking me if I could think of someone who might want to do this because I was doing many, many other things at the time. And they said, I'll give it some thought. And then I called them back 10 minutes later and said, I want to do this. I am the person who wants to do this. And we've been working on it ever since, about a year and a half now. And it's been great fun, and I'm sort of still excited to see where we're headed next.
Well, and it was a huge part of your history, I suppose, to have three of the first eight Kindle serials be from your group. Did they approach you, or did you approach them?
They approached us, and that was very fortuitous for us, because at that point, we were just trying to figure out, what can we do with this? I mean, how are we going to launch these things? And how will anyone know what on earth we mean when we say serialized fiction? And we were really grappling with that at that point. And then all of a sudden, Jenny got this call saying, Amazon wants to do serials. And we had about five titles ready to go at that point, you know, and we still weren't sure what to do with them. So it was very welcome news to us. And we said, you know, absolutely, we'd love to take part in this. And we sent them our novels that we'd been working on. And it was a wonderful working relationship right from the get-go.
I've been speaking with Yael Goldstein-Love, who is co-founder and editorial director at Plimpton, which is creating serialized fiction for digital readers. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I want to close by thanking those of you who filled out the survey that I put up at SurveyMonkey. I got 56 responses. 100% of them have an e-ink Kindle, and just half reported having a Fire or an iPad. Interview is the favorite part of the show. 41% chose that as their favorite part, followed by news 32%, tech tip 23%, and content just 3% and 0% for listener comments. I was gratified to see that 19% have been listening for about a year, 51% more than a year, and a very impressive 28% of you have been listening since my very first show in July of 2008. The freeform comments were very helpful, and I'll be reading them closely to help improve the show. This is Len Edgerly in Cambridge, Massachusetts for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.